Hi, I'm Dr. Z, and this is the Natural House Call. We're really excited to be here with you on WPKN Bridgeport 89.5 FM, listener-sponsored free speech alternative radio. And with us, we have a special guest today, Carol Peterson, who's an accomplished compounding pharmacist with decades of experience helping patients improve their quality of life through bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, which is part of what we'll be talking about today. She graduated from the University of Wisconsin School of Pharmacy and is also a certified nutritional practitioner. Her passion to optimize health and commitment to compounding is evident in her involvement with organizations, including the International College of Integrated Medicine, the American College of Apothecaries, the Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine, the American Pharmacist Association, and the Alliance for Pharmacy Compounding. She's also the founder and first chair for Compounding Special Interest Group with the American Pharmacist Association. She chairs the Integrated Medicine Consortium, an umbrella group for complementary medicine organizations. She also co-hosts a radio program, which I've been a guest on, in the greater New York area, Take Charge of Your Health, and is on the Medical Advisory Center for the Center of Menstrual Cycle and Ovulation Research. She writes, edits, does her radio, is on a website called worldhealth.net, and co-producer of Immortality Now. Talk to her about that. She offers personal consultations at The Wellness by Design Project, all one word, no punctuation.com. Welcome, Carol. It's great to have you on again.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Z. It's great to be here. So,
we met at a conference a while ago.
Yes.
Just to let people know, and we had dinner, and we just kind of were just so passionate, our conversation about all your work with hormones and understanding them, even different hormones that we don't really think about as far as affecting our brain and the interplay and marriage of all the hormones and endocrine system with other systems. So that's what I found fascinating, is like you have such a holistic outlook about the hormones, that the thyroid influences the adrenals and influences this and influences the reproductive system. And so that's what blew me away about your work. So welcome again. And I'm really excited to have you on there. What have you been doing lately as far as researching and reading?
Oh, my goodness. I'm going down several rabbit holes. And I think it's beginning to explain some problems that are occurring with people and their hormones. And I'd like to say right now it's critical. We have been through almost 3 years of a situation that has really devastated our hormones. Our adrenal hormones are crashing, and then our sex hormones are at levels that we've never seen before. It's really taken a toll on our fertility, on our ability to reproduce, just all the stress that we're enduring, if I say nothing else. Just the stress is enough to do all that of everything going on. But this is layered with many, many more things. But I'm reaching my 30th anniversary of really looking at hormones, particularly the steroidal ones. And that's vitamin D is included, the sex hormones, adrenal, bile. And every day is really bringing more and more information to integrate. So I really, really would like to share with you some of the latest things I've been digging into. We have a lot of people, men and women both, out there who are suffering needlessly and horribly because of hormone disarray. And I'd like to go into some of all the other systems that are playing into it. So I do have a hierarchy of hormones, and my hierarchy starts with insulin and glucose, which are the most primitive and the most basic of hormones. And we have an epidemic emerging of insulin resistance. There's several factors playing into this, but we have been very negligent. Our practitioners don't routinely measure fasting insulin along with fasting glucose. And I just had a revelation from a colleague of mine who told me she had a client who was on a continuous glucose meter. And this is a new development. We're able to put on a patch, which does poke into the bloodstream and measure your glucose all the time. And what this client told her was that whenever she had a hot flash, her glucose dropped to 50. So let me say like 80, 90 is kind of normal after you eat 120, but 50 is precariously low. We've never looked at that before, have we? We haven't had the technology. So it's amazing to me to hear that. What I'd like to say, we still don't know the insulin, and we still don't know the insulin resistance. Oh, excuse me. So we have things to learn from that insulin glucose thing. But let me tell you what happens when glucose drops. And this is the source of a lot of sleep problems and maybe the hot flashes too. When glucose drops, your adrenal glands, particularly adrenaline, are called in to bring up the glucose to your brain. So what comes along with the adrenaline? Cortisol comes along, but symptoms that you experience with that high adrenaline is anxiety, heart palpitations, panic attacks. You may end up in the hospital thinking you're having a heart attack. Can be men or women, but adrenaline has come out in full force trying to keep the glucose up. If you are somebody who goes to sleep easily, but wake up in the early hours of the morning and you can't go back to sleep because your mind is so busy, you've experienced that same thing. During the night, you haven't stored enough glycogen in your liver and you wake fully awake. Your cortisol's up, your adrenaline's up. You can't quiet your brain and you can't go back to sleep. So what's the thing you can do? Years ago, there was some dentists. They were dentally trained, but they were really endocrinologists. And this one called it liver insomnia from not being able to store enough glycogen. Well, this liver insomnia can be relieved in the middle of the night with two things that I know about. One is to eat something. This dentist recommended an apple at your bedside and eat it because of some of the fast acting sugars, but also a lot of fiber to give you an even glucose. Another thing that will help that is progesterone. Most people do not know that progesterone is the natural balancer of adrenaline. And getting that in, an extra dose that night can help put you back to sleep. In fact, progesterone is very good for getting to sleep too. If you're low on progesterone and you can't settle, progesterone does not make you drowsy, except sometimes with the oral form, you get allopregnanolone, really another powerful brain steroid as well as progesterone. But this can make you as sleepy as if you used phenobarbital or some of those drugs. It'll knock you right out. There are some women, if you take oral progesterone, it will do that. And this applies to men too. Years ago, they used to actually use progesterone for helping men sleep as well. Same thing. So we have this whole insulin, glucose, adrenal glands, and now affecting also the sex hormones, because when cortisol along with the adrenaline go up, we have some problems. We're not able to produce as much testosterone or as much estradiol, or even as much progesterone. So I'm finding that there's a certain subset of women that I've been working with, and they hit perimenopause and their lives are trashed. They're experiencing a lot of this high adrenaline. It's not uncommon for women to be running to the emergency room because they surely believe they're going to die. And progesterone is the first hormone that dips during perimenopause. These poor women get put on anti-anxiety drugs, sometimes antidepressant drugs, sleep aids if they're not sleeping, but it's progesterone that has become very, very deficit. Then progesterone, usually really big, abundant amounts of progesterone are produced by the ovaries once a month during the second part of the cycle, mid-cycle ovulation to the end of the cycle. We have a whole massive amount of progesterone ideally being released, and that gives women a great cushion. But in perimenopause, we're starting to even have normal bleeding, looks like normal bleeding, but we don't ovulate. And we don't get the big surge of progesterone that we should be having. We get some surge or you wouldn't bleed, but the generous amount of progesterone we should be having is being depleted. And then we may have depletions in the first part of the cycle. This is something people and practitioners too, they do not realize that progesterone is abundant, should be in the follicular first part of the cycle, and give you a ton of progesterone there too. Not as much as the luteal, but in comparison to other hormones, it's like 1,000 times the amount of estradiol a woman makes. It's about 500 times the amount of testosterone that is made by a woman. So this is a huge problem that is neglected. And what happens when that progesterone from the adrenal glands is depleted, women build up more tissue in their endometrium. So also consistent with perimenopause is suddenly women have these huge bleeds every month, and it's agonizing. And some even reach the hospital again for a blood transfusion. It's that critical. But what hasn't happened is they didn't have enough progesterone in the first part of the cycle to allow it to moderate the buildup that's being caused by estrogen. In perimenopause, according to Dr. Jerry Lynn Pryor, women have the highest estrogen during their whole lifespan. However, it's amazing. She had trouble getting this work published because the prevailing attitude is, oh, estrogen's going down. And many doctors will treat that type of woman, giving them extra estrogen, making the problem even worse. And when they do that, now there's so much bleeding, so much discomfort, so much lack of sleep, so much panic, that they advise that the woman have a hysterectomy, including oophorectomy, and their problems are over. So in the U.S., about 700,000 surgeries are performed on women, removing their uterus, often with the ovaries. And even if the ovaries aren't removed, often the surgery has damaged the ovaries so much that they no longer produce hormones for you. So it's a travesty. Then we have these wonderful organizations, North American Menopause Society, the Endocrine Society, the Association ACOG, that's Obstetrics and Gynecology. They form their committees, and their committees are highly influenced by people who are highly influenced by the drug industry. So they have these guidelines, like if you've had a hysterectomy or an oophorectomy, doctors may give you a prescription for estrogen. But no, you don't need progesterone because that's what was supposed to be protecting the uterus, but it wasn't. And that's all you need progesterone for. So you don't need you don't need to continue and use progesterone. This is so off base. And all you need to do is go do lab testing and see for yourself. You have a devastating loss of hormones because of these surgeries, and your doctor will only treat you with one hormone out of balance with everything else, and you're on your way to more misery. Unless your adrenal glands can help you. And this is where all this stress comes in. So when women meet menopause and become symptomatic, and men also suffer with andropause, we're having to do all the sex hormone functioning with the adrenal glands. And if your adrenal glands have been steadily exhausted because of stress, you can't do it. And bang, you are instantly symptomatic with a surgery, a little more gradually if you are just aging and your ovaries and your testes are no longer putting out as many hormones, you hit that wall. So these women in this situation really need progesterone to save them from a lot of problems. And when I started working, I worked with PMS, very severe PMS, women who were extremely anxious. They were murderous even. Wow. They were. Maybe you've met a few.
Yeah.
So extreme migraine problems can be involved. And all kinds of situations. So at the time, and I'm talking 30 years ago, we started using progesterone, and we could help those women become comfortable with very, very high levels. So you have high estrogens, high progesterone, comfort. But as time went on, we learned this doesn't have to be the case, because this estrogen is way too high. And maybe if we address that, then the progesterone need is not as great. And so it seems there are so many things contributing to a high estrogen. We do this thing with abnormal microbiome. We recycle our own estrogen. We have trouble getting rid of it. If we don't give the liver the methyl groups or the sulfur groups to conjugate the estrogen and move it along, it's gonna stick. It's gonna keep staying in the bloodstream, actually building up in the bloodstream. We have metals in our mouth that sit on estrogen receptors. Mercury's been shown to do that, cadmium too. So it acts as an estrogen. We have pesticides, insecticides, that pernicious glyphosate, which is everywhere, is actually estrogenic. So we have this huge burden of estrogen. And now many functional doctors have this information now. We're starting to be able to bring that down. But recently, I read a book, Kara Fitzgerald, called Younger You. And she was talking about methylation. And methylation comes from like the B vitamins. I donate methyl groups to our body, and so does choline, phosphatidylcholine, betaine, SAMe. Some people may have tried SAMe for methyl groups. And you can tell by a simple blood test if you're methylating very well or not. It's homocysteine. And some doctors routinely do measure homocysteine. But it can, if it's elevated, there's not enough methyl groups to metabolize that. There's not enough methyl groups for that. You don't have enough for your estrogens. I mentioned before, you need to conjugate estrogens with methyl groups. So that needs to be there. But in her book, I just had a, you know how things just strike
she's
you?
She's one of my students.
Really?
Yeah. One of my students. Yeah.
How cool is that? Because at the beginning of the book, she writes about adrenaline needs to be methylated. I go,
Yeah, it's a good connection between the whole homocysteine and the adrenaline thing you were talking about, yeah.
Right. And I go, oh my gosh, I've been ignoring this. And just surely enough, I go to the internet and I find a rather old paper. It was maybe 40, 50 years old. It says that methylation is the primary metabolizing thing that is needed for both adrenaline and noradrenaline, which it turns into. So if you don't have enough methylation, then you can't bring down the adrenaline either. So I think where I thought that we were addressing high estrogen and needed high progesterone, now I think because adrenaline's in there too, I'm beginning to think of some of those attributes, the heart pounding, the panic, the anxiety, may not be just estrogen's fault. It could be adrenaline's fault. And what happens with these poor women, they don't have enough progesterone to balance. Their diet is awry and contributes to that excess adrenaline production. So your brain gets the glucose it wants. And we're ignoring the methylation factor part of this, that methyl groups could be very low and would be needed both to help bring down the excessive estrogen and bring down the excessive adrenaline. So that's my latest piece that I'm investigating, but I think I'm on the right track. There's a serious methylation, and I thought Kara Fitzgerald's book was awesome.
I had her on. We talked about it. But the old time naturopathic doctors always prescribed these things called lipotropic agents, which were all the methyl donors, and they would have herbs that would help the liver. They were cholagogues and choleretics, and then the methyl donors like the choline and inositol and specific types of B12, folic acid, B6. So it's kind of interesting that they were kind of way ahead of their time, even though they didn't really know about homocysteine back, like when I went to school. I mean, we knew about it, but they didn't know really the ramifications of how it influences damage to your arteries and damage to your brain, and it's really important to keep that homocysteine down. I mean, homocysteine is a naturally occurring amino acid in the body, but it has to be recycled. It can't accumulate. It's like, the dam can't be blocked. And so by taking those good herbs that help the liver. And we always remember that the liver really is like a chemical detox factory. It detoxifies your environmental things that you mentioned before, and your hormones too. That's a very important point that you kind of stumbled on.
I think it is. It's like as you read things, I might read a whole book and there'd be one statement that like electrifies me because it fills in a missing piece in my brain. Now, I could be wrong. I could definitely be wrong about this, about trying to help your adrenaline metabolism. But you could check, you can try it, you can measure homocysteine and see if that's awry. You can have genetic testing for your ability to methylate. And I'm not sure that gives you that much information. I've heard like 40% of the population doesn't methylate as well as the other 60%. So when I buy B vitamins, I buy the methylated ones. I'm not going to test myself genetically, but I'm going to say, why not have the activated B vitamins? You pay a little bit more for those methylated Bs, but at least you have the methyl groups active that you need. So I think that's very important. So
The listeners should know that like, because we were under the impression, and from so many generations, that when we get our B vitamins from our food, that's the end of the equation, that, oh, we're getting, we're eating lots of greens to get the folic acid and lots of products to get the B12 and B6 and things to have choline, like, rich egg yolks and or vegan sources. But the problem is that many generations of people, particularly more northern Europeans, that have that what they call SNP, which is a genetic mutation, they can't, like you said, they can't take those B vitamins from their food and add these special carbon, hydrogen, methyl groups to then allow those the body to use the B vitamins. So they suffer, and they suffer from so many things. And I thought that they suffered from, depression and fixing their DNA and making glutathione, but I didn't really realize that it had a ramification with your sexual hormones till I actually read one of your things. And then I'm like, yeah, you're right, because those have to be metabolized by the liver. And then I don't, I guess, are those hormones, do they have to be methylated too to be activated? Or is it just have to do with the detoxification?
Detoxification for
Okay.
the estrogens,
Yeah.
but not all the hormones are detoxified like that. They have different pathways, so it's not universal. But when you're thinking you're dealing with an excess estrogen and excess adrenaline, that's going to be so important. So let me say just another thing, because what happens, and I'm on a crusade for women to use enough progesterone. And I have to blame and congratulate John Lee way back when he wrote a book and he lectured extensively on the benefits of progesterone. However, he also wrote that women needed to only use about 16 milligrams of progesterone a day and in the over-the-counter creams. And that indeed might be adequate for those who are aging gently, but I'm going to tell you that puts women in hormone hell. And they feel like they can't use progesterone, because what immediately happens is every estradiol, and now I think adrenaline activity, is suddenly enhanced. And again, this is taking women to the emergency room thinking they are dying. And I know from my days with PMS, when it was severe, we'd start out with 100 milligram capsules with progesterone and oil 4 times a day and increase from there, using doses I've seen as high as 2400, 2500 milligrams of progesterone. When I mean high progesterone was needed to quell all that symptomatology, which is really, really severe. So way too many women have tried the over-the-counter creams, which for the most part are extremely low dose and make themselves worse, and are convinced that progesterone is the devil itself. And we even have practitioners teaching other practitioners. This just makes me crazy. Start low and go slow. When you talk to progesterone, that can be a death knell for a successful hormone therapy. Let me tell you. Jerry Lynn Pryor, who I mentioned before, I talked to her. She says she never sees this, but she never starts anybody on less than 300 milligrams in capsules. She uses capsules. So, of course, that phenomenon is not occurring in her patients, but it is occurring in lots. And how I know this is not being in a pharmacy anymore and doing consultations all the time. I felt that piece was missing. So I started watching some Facebook groups, and there is where the misery lurks. And doctors don't even know the damage they're causing their patients, because the patients will just drop them and be miserable and go to another and go to another and often give up. And they are a great target, as I said, for the pharmaceutical industry, because there's so many things going wrong. Insulin glucose, as I said before, they're going to be starting insulin resistance massively. They'll be put on metformin at least for sure to start, and then all the hormone disarrays. You can't sleep. You have high anxiety. You get depressed. You have no energy. We've got drugs for a lot of these things, so you could easily end up trying to patch yourself up with drugs. And have 20, 30 drugs go in no time, at least by the time you get to the nursing home with all that.
Right.
So it's a travesty. So I want to say, please, 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 those of you who need progesterone, use a lot. And if any of this comes up, use more immediately. And then use more and more. And when you restore the calm, you'll be there.
Interesting.
It's it's such an important thing. And
Now, what about some of the hormones that, make your progesterone? I know we had a great conversation on this hormone that hardly anyone tests for, which is called pregnenolone. That's kind of like, I call it the grandmother of all the steroids, because from pregnenolone, many things can be birthed and made. But you said that it's not only, I remember at a lecture that you gave, it's not only going to the sexual hormone balancing, but it has very important effects on the brain.
Yep, it's one of the more important neurosteroids. The brain is kind of interesting because hormones are made independently in the brain, and they can get in the brain actually through the blood-brain barrier, through the bloodstream too. So we forget this, like hormones we think are only made by the certain glands. No. All your nerve cells produce pregnenolone and progesterone. Use it right there. Never gets in the bloodstream to measure. We don't really measure our brains either, but different parts of our brain, and our brain is full of cholesterol, which all of this comes from. All the enzymes are up there doing this metabolism of various hormones, and they do it like certain parts of the brain will have more of this one, less of this one. I got this from a book. By a guy by the name of Stephen King, strangely enough. It's called Neurosteroids, and it's all about how the hormones act in the brain. And the hormones are very active in the brain. There's so many things that we label as mental illness that could be a lack of hormones. I know successful treatment of anxiety, depression, and bipolar, obsessive compulsive, all kinds of things with hormones. But I would put a caveat on there because we also know that there are non-steroidal brain chemicals that aren't related to cholesterol, and they play a great deal of work in the brain. But these are actually the seed of those other ones, really are the gut and our microbiome in the gut. So we really need to be paying attention to our microbiome and keeping that happy. And then under abnormal circumstances like candida overgrowth, candida mycotoxins can bind estrogen. Some of the organisms make estrogen. So we have a hormone factory going on in our gut as well, not to mention things like serotonin. So this is so amazing to me. We also have, I'd like to just bring out a point that very few people know, but we have this, what's it called? Mast cell something, something. They've made it a disease. So many people are getting cancer.
MCAS, yeah.
So what's the A stand for?
Cell activation syndrome.
Yes. But inside each mast cell, there's a little factory making hormones. And if estrogen is dominant with not enough progesterone, estrogen dominance pushes out histamine, and progesterone is an antihistamine. So all
Progesterone is
those.
an antihistamine. Oh, that's I need to tell one of my patients that's been suffering from the MCAS, but her estrogen is very extremely low. I've seen that in COVID, even though she's supplementing with estrogen,
Right,
seems to be
but
very
the
low.
blood tests, urine tests, saliva tests. Now I hear there's hair and nail tests for
Yeah.
hormones. It does not tell you intracellular concentrations of hormones. We don't have any way to measure it. So it's circulating, you could have, but locally you could have an excess in the mast cells.
I see.
So there was, I think this research, there was some researcher at McGill that's written extensively on intracrinology, inside the cell, and the basic hormone there is DHEA. From DHEA, inside your cells make the whole complement of sex and adrenal hormones. So it's staggering how complicated it can be. So we're still, I'd say we're in the dark ages. It's kind of like you mentioned before, like with the herbs and stuff. We know hormones can do a great deal of good if you stick to the bioidentical ones, if you give people enough, as I said, with progesterone, if you try and balance out what else is going on, if you work with all that, we can provide a great deal of relief to patients. But we really don't know what we're doing. In the There's so many things still undefined. And so we like to use tests for some sort of marker, but the tests really are quite fallible. What's really infallible is the patient themselves. And I think naturopathic medicine has a really fine history of listening to the patient. I did a consultation. It was so amazing the other day because they say if you listen to a patient, they'll tell you what's wrong. And then if you listen further, they'll tell you what to do. And I'll be darned, this patient,
Yeah, that's
this
true.
patient in under an hour. And I was just listening. But that's what's needed. It's an essential function. And doctors are no longer trained to listen. They're trained to follow a flow chart. I wrote a
Tell me,
thing.
I just want to interrupt you one second because I want to ask you about the compounding pharmacy part of your training, and that is misunderstood by a lot of people. A lot of there's been some bad press about compounding pharmacy and things like that. So tell us a little bit about what a compounding pharmacy even is. I can't be remiss in asking you that because it's such an important part of your training, and I think we need to write the correct the information misinformation that's out there.
Okay, so out there, and it's coming from pharma-related things because really they don't want that option. They want everybody using their drugs, and no other options. So compounding allows you to personalize what you're doing. So a couple things they say about compounding: it's not regulated. It's actually more heavily regulated than the pharmaceutical industry is, as far as quality. For example, through the U U.S. Pharmacopeia, which we have to follow in compounding, they have limits on how you can deviate. So when something says it's 5 milligrams, it's not 5 milligrams, and every tablet isn't 5 milligrams. It's humanly impossible to do that. But you have some dosage range that you're allowed, and you'll find that actually stated in the USP. But the USP also says if you're compounding, you have to be plus or minus 10% of what your stated value is. There are some accepted prescription drugs where the USP allows a deviation of 20% each way. That's incredible.
Oh,
I
wow.
know. So it's not necessarily that pharma is better. We're held to a higher standard in compounding. Compounding is both regulated federally as well as with each state as doctors and nurses and pharmacists and pharmacies and hospitals are all regulated. There's a ton of regulation for that. The ingredients, sometimes people say, oh, well, they like you to imagine you pick up some progesterone from some slime ball place and
Yeah.
it's full of impurities. Now, again, we're held to that standard. If we buy a powder, we have to have a certificate of analysis. That product has to be like 99.9% pure. And otherwise, you don't use it because it's got contaminants and you don't know what the contaminants are and you don't have time to test for it. And why would you? Because you don't want to use that product. So it's rejected. Usually it's rejected already at the wholesaler. But when I worked in pharmacy, we bought some things direct and we had it retested as a wholesaler would do to make sure that product was absolutely pure. And I remember one time we had one 95% only. We couldn't use it. So we don't use it. Things like that happen.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, thanks for telling us about that because people don't know. And I know the only news story I remember was maybe 2 years ago. There was a problem with a compounding pharmacy in Massachusetts, and they were, I don't know, bad sort of yellow journalism. So if you're just joining us, we're talking to Carol Peterson. She's an accomplished compounding pharmacist with decades of experience helping people improve the quality of health through bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, a grad of University of Wisconsin School of Pharmacy, and a certified nutritional practitioner. We're doing a deep dive into hormones. So we also wanted to talk a little bit about, and this is what I've been reading about and what piqued my interest because, I've seen your newsletter, but I really, really went when you talked about nitric oxide. I was so interested because I had just been reading all kinds of things about nitric oxide and the history of nitric oxide, not only as a, something that was used to as an anesthetic, but now, of course, as a powerful messenger molecule in the body. And I had no idea that the nitric oxide was also related to the sexual hormone. So give us a little bit of background about nitric oxide and what it's used for in our body, and then how it's related to this interplay of hormones.
Okay, will you entertain that I use a back door to go into there?
Sure, yeah.
What I want to do is introduce a book that was written by Dr. Malcolm Kendrick,
Huh.
and it's called The Clot Thickens. And he's got a marvelous sense of humor. He writes a very dense and well-referenced story, like a an investigator like Sherlock Holmes would work out everything. So he's been a long time opponent of the cholesterol and atherosclerosis plaque formation thing, and so he spent like the last 20 years putting together this hypothesis, and he's not the only one, is that atherosclerosis is formed by blood clots. And the blood clots actually, your body, it goes under the epithelium, the lining of the blood vessel. And for some reason, your body's not able to activate the enzymes it needs to resolve it. And sometimes in various vulnerable parts of your body, you get stack upon stack upon stack of clots that have been unresolved. He said you can even see when they cut these things up, there's like layers, like the rings of a tree. So you can see the history of blood clots. So how does that happen? So the epithelium is that lining of all your blood cells, and it's got a little protective little hairy things called the glycocalyx to protect it, but it's pretty vulnerable. I mentioned homocysteine before. That's one of the things that can bother your epithelium. And so can all kinds of things like smoking, as you get the particulate into your bloodstream, and that's irritating. All kinds of toxic substances can cause some damage to your epithelium, or you don't have enough glycoproteins, a glucose and a protein together, which make the glycocalyx. You don't have enough of that protecting it. So the endothelium is at risk. And so when your body finds like it's bleeding, it'll make a blood clot. And normally, under normal circumstances, a little insult, you can heal that, nothing happens. But if that area is particularly vulnerable, you stack up those things. So I'm convinced that he's on the right track. So what does he say is one of the most important?
The lining of your arteries has these epithel has this lining, and that gets damaged with the beginning of hardening of the arteries, like basically.
Right. And you don't, it doesn't form outside the epithelium. We see these pictures, like cross sections, and they make it up. It doesn't have this waxy thing that we've been taught to believe is this great big hardened thing. No, it's underneath the epithelium
Right.
that lines all the blood vessels. So what's one of the most important things you can do for your epithelium? It's the area where you form nitric oxide. So I said I was coming through the back door. So nitric oxide is formed in a flash. It can't be measured. It comes and goes very quickly, but it causes a relaxation of those cells in the epithelium. And with that, in turn, affects your circulation to every place in your body. So that's why nitric oxide is so pervasive. You need that dilation. We have little capillaries that are tinier than the red blood cells that are needed to carry the oxygen to that capillary. And if we don't have that circulation throughout our body, to our skin, to our organs, we're going to start having those organs and skin and everything suffer. And it's a huge thing connected with aging. As we age, our nitric oxide goes down, and we have poor and poor circulation, poor and poor oxygenation of our bodies. Now, I want to interject here so I don't leave this behind. What does he say is some of the most important things you can do for nitric oxide production? He goes, you have the ability in your skin to make nitric oxide like crazy, but you have to be in the sun to activate it, which I found pretty interesting. And there's another interesting thing about nitric oxide. You have the ability in your nose to create nitric oxide if you breathe through your nose.
Wow.
If you breathe through your mouth, you're not going to get the nitric oxide formation. And there's even a biohack with people taping their mouth at night. Since my dentist says the proper place for at rest, your tongue sits on your upper palate calmly, and your mouth is closed. So that's how you should be breathing all the time, or almost all the time. If you get some congestion, I guess you can have some problems. But so that's a technique. There's another thing, in your mouth. There are bacteria there that can work on the nitrates you eat, turn it to nitrite, and then turn it into nitric oxide. That bacteria is destroyed. If you go along and eat something like, or not eat something, use mouthwashes, all these mouthwashes that are designed to exactly do that, kill bacteria. But you need those beneficial ones. If you don't have enough stomach acid, you can't make nitric oxide. So let me start with thyroid. So we long associate low thyroid with cold hands and feet, poor circulation to the skin. And so if your thyroid is not working well, can this not be an inability of nitric oxide either to be formed or activated? So that's a concern. There's a big tie-in there that I think there were like several different ways where thyroid would interact with nitric oxide. So not there's an important enzyme called nitric oxide synthase, and that enzyme's responsible for turning the nitrite into the NO. And so you want to make sure that enzyme is there and active. So the hormones, if you don't have enough nitric oxide, you may have high cortisol. As I mentioned at the beginning, we are in a situation where we're stressed. Our cortisol and adrenaline goes up from our adrenals. So in the absence of enough NO, our body actually raises the cortisol level. Cortisol, when it's too high, it's been called a death hormone. But I'm going to be making doing a lot more writing in this area of cortisol because it's also essential. So it's this Goldilocks kind of hormone. You've got to have it just right. Not too much, not too little. Too little, you're going to suffer all kinds of reactivity to everything. It's anti-inflammatory. You're going to have things like arthritis and all kinds of inflammation. When it's too much, now it's downregulating your sex hormones, downregulating a lot of stuff. And on top of that, it's pulling your progesterone to oblivion to make more. Till you can't. And when you can't, because that high and sustained cortisol, if you have it measured and it's high, you at least can react. But over time, if this continues, this is gonna flatline. And you will, if you want to know what chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia feel like, it's when this cortisol has flatlined, all those symptoms of fatigue and pain in the muscles and joints. That's how chronic fatigue feels like. That's how the flu feels like. And now I just saw a study that linked post-COVID, long COVID. People have had some infections and they don't really recover. And this is true of how they first characterized chronic fatigue. It was some sort of infection in Incline Village, 200 patients in a practice over a short period of time got so ill after the infection that they were unable to get out of their beds. And this is when cortisol is devastated. So this is a part of the long COVID syndrome. It's already been published. DHEA, that other adrenal hormone, we haven't talked too much about that. It's a steroid, unlike adrenaline. But it has a lot of to do with our stability. And DHEA does increase NO. And if you don't have enough DHEA, you have NO deficiency related things like erectile dysfunction in men and low libido in women, which is also concerned with the blood flow. So that's also hooked into DHEA. Testosterone directly creates NO if you don't have enough testosterone. And again, back to the circulation issue, back to erectile dysfunction or no morning erection. You need enough NO and testosterone to do that. So progesterone both increases NO and increases that enzyme that you need.
Does it go both ways? Where could a man take NO releasers and they would actually maybe make more testosterone, or would that just benefit the nitric oxide.
Okay, some of this idea is the basis for the drugs like Viagra and Cialis
Right.
to create more NO, but there's a problem with it. It doesn't always work, and it doesn't work if you don't have the precursor nitrates and nitrites to get to NO. If that's missing, you can't do it very well with the drug. So it can actually overuse would also deplete this, and so then you're depleting all this other circulation to your body. But that's how the drugs were devised. And they're also trying to work out a drug for women for sexual release. But oxytocin too
Okay.
increases that enzyme. So oxytocin, it's called the love hormone, but it's how we interact. So you can increase oxytocin by being with your friends, hugging, and sex. Not only the act of sex, but when you have a release, you have a climax. Both men and women, their oxytocin goes way up, and it has this sense of helping with the relationship with the two of you. It's the hormone that really helps the relationship build it into a loving one when there's oxytocin. I guess that's why we have sex.
I think massage too. I
I
read
don't
massage.
Massage
So I think.
is absolutely right.
Well, yeah.
And one of the things, estrogen too. Estrogen, they think can help. Another thing that does help NO is if you use antioxidants, because NO has an antioxidant function. And if you don't have enough antioxidants on board, so NO becomes more and more depleted because it's doing that antioxidant function. So if you do supplement with antioxidants, your NO has more ability to be used as its function on the epithelium of your blood vessels and getting your circulation and oxygenation everywhere. So it triggers, you need NO in your bloodstream to trigger the pituitary LH luteinizing hormone. Luteinizing hormone is what gives you that wonderful surge of progesterone from ovulation on. LH is supposed to be surging, so you make progesterone, and LH is critical for men to make testosterone. You don't have it, you don't get it. So it's all entwined. I think there was something more I wanted to say. Oh, estrogen is an antioxidant, so they say that antioxidant effect of estrogen is helping maintain your NO function. So, like everything else is, everything's intertwined with each other, and you can't just separate things. But if you start to realize, let's say you have symptoms. Oh, and the estrogen, as your estrogen goes down, after 85. Most women are starting to have to cope with high blood pressure, or they say as you're aging, you're coping with high blood pressure. So estrogen's protective for that, but it is indeed, you should be looking for that anytime there's a blood pressure problem. Is there enough NO? And so where do we get the NO from? So I said nitrate to nitrite to nitric oxide. So we've been warned, not to have cured bacon and stuff because it's full of nitrates, nitrites, whatever. But it actually isn't the danger that we were told. Like a lot of things, sometimes it doesn't hold up. My favorite thing, I love bacon. So
Oh boy, that's
that might be something to it. So where do you get
beets.
it
How
from?
about beets, Carol? There's a lot of commercials about beets that release nitric oxide and it's superfood. And what is your readings on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Beets is one of the richest sources of nitrates
Wow.
that
Okay.
we have in the vegetable kingdom. And green leafy greens are another, particularly kale and spinach are the highest. And then the amino acid arginine is needed as a precursor for NO. So you find that in various supplements. They'll have like concentrated greens, concentrated beets. Some actually supplement with nitrates directly, so you don't have to extract it from your food. Supplements are like that. So in general, making sure you have enough NO is a really good healthy aging strategy because NO is so essential for the circulation to each and every cell in our body. And this causes problems for our conventional medicine paradigm and the flow chart issue. Because NO does affect every cell in the body, you may have one area affected more than another area for whatever's going on in your makeup. So doctors have trouble with these all-encompassing things like thyroid 2 affects T3, T3 thyroid is needed in each and every mitochondria in each and every cell. So a low thyroid produces all sorts of symptoms. And practitioners learn a few symptoms, and if they're too pervasive, they're not able to understand that this is unified under a pretty common deficiency. So we have all that going on.
Interesting that you mentioned the thyroid, because and the inability to really measure hormones inside the cell, because I think the same thing is with thyroid. What's your take about thyroid problems that aren't really diagnosed by the blood tests? Like, your blood tests look great, but you could still have thyroid problems. Am I right?
Yes. Okay, so first of all, I do rely a little bit on thyroid testing, but not on just a TSH, which is a pituitary hormone, which is supposed to stimulate your thyroid to make more thyroid hormone. And when TSH starts to elevate, then we start to think the thyroid can't work very well because of the lack of responsiveness to that TSH. This is one component of what could be happening. And I just talked to somebody, her mom had a TSH of 34, and they managed to get it down to 20. TSH is a pro-oxidant kind of hormone, and
Yes,
friend
aging.
of mine, Jeff Bolles, has been studying what causes programmed aging, which is his theory. He thinks LH and FSH, I mentioned LH before, FSH is follicle stimulating hormone from the pituitary, but then there's TSH. And I said to him, I think you can make the same argument that you're making for LH and FSH, that they're as they rise, as you're unable to stimulate enough hormone production with those signals, they keep going up. Well, so does TSH keep going up as you age and you become more hypothyroid. So I like to see TSH around one. If it's not around one, I already get nervous. And then the normal is like from 0.5 or even
4 point
0.05,
something.
I've Yeah, all the way to 3.5. You also have to look for secondary hypothyroidism. If you're lower than that one, and you have all kinds of low thyroid symptoms, too many doctors think you're hyper because too much thyroid would drive down your TSH. And so will some when you take thyroid, it drives down your TSH. So many doctors, it's strange how much ignorance is out there, can't recognize secondary hypothyroidism from your pituitary, just isn't making enough TSH. Now, there's In a thyroid panel, I'd like to see free and total T3 and T4. Free T3 is your active hormone, but you need enough T4 around to be able to do that. And I like to see these on like three quarters of the range. I want antibodies to be tested. I've seen estimates like 60% of low thyroid people have antibodies, and they usually call it Hashimoto's. And it's very strange, this being so prevalent, how little doctors actually test to see the antibodies. And so what's going on if there's thyroid antibodies? You've got a gut microbiome problem because they've already identified some bacteria that if it's making it through your gut wall into the bloodstream, pieces of the toxins for these various bacteria have enough in common with your with parts of your body that there's cross sensitivities, and you make antibodies to these little pieces, but then it'll go and attack your thyroid. I've seen like Yersinia is a bacteria in your gut that's related to Hashimoto's. So any kind of autoimmune anything, not only autoimmune thyroid, you need to look to repairing your gut. That's another big naturopathic principle that you do not see in conventional medicine. And then there's reverse T3. As I mentioned, T3 is the active hormone, but your body can make a like a mirror image of that T3, and this is inactive when it sits in the cell, and it's called like a hibernation hormone. When your body makes reverse T3, you're hypothyroid because you don't have active T3, but your body may be doing that, probably is doing that for a reason. And there's could be some stressors going on, whatever. You should look into the whole story with that patient to see what might be causing that freeze into the reverse thyroid. And actually, the conference that you and I were at was put on by Dennis Wilson, who has a whole therapy for restoring reverse T3 back to active T3. So there's that issue too. And
I mean,
we don't know the
there's
half.
one more. There's one more obstacle that I've seen. It's like they call it like peripheral conversion of your T4 to T3. It's like, you know, when people take levothyroxine or Synthroid or other drugs like that. So that's the T4, but then they have to
They
make
have
it
to
to the
convert.
T3, and that takes selenium and zinc and a calm mind, and probably
And
other factors that we don't even know about too much.
that occurs inside the cell. So
Yes.
you have two problems. The T4 has to get in there, and then you have to have the enzymes working well enough inside the cell to make that conversion. So
Right.
all this thyroid stuff is extremely, extremely complicated.
Yeah.
And yet, endocrinologists, I'm often asked by people when they have issues with their hormones, should I see an endocrinologist? And I found out that endocrinologists think they should do two things. They treat low thyroid with T4 only and monitor TSH, and they treat diabetes. So I don't think these endocrinologists are doing a service in the few things they do
Yeah,
most of the time. They are not servicing their patients. So it's a big problem.
well, Carol, we're running out of time for this edition, so we really want to thank you for your, you know, sharing this amazing little lecture on endocrinology. This is something that I hope listeners can re-listen to in the podcast and take notes and learn so much. We learned so much about glucose and diabetes and progesterone being this misunderstood and amazing. I like the idea that you said that progesterone helps people sleep with insomnia a lot of times. And I have a lot of women with insomnia that aren't responding to drugs or even natural things that we'll have to look at the progesterone. And certainly a lot of good information on nitric oxide. Where could people get in touch with you if they have more questions and or follow your blogs or even listen to your radio show? We'll be broadcasting in the greater Connecticut area, reaching maybe parts of New York State.
Okay. So actually the best place is my website. You mentioned it earlier. It's the wellnessbydesignproject.com. And the radio show is archived. My blogs are archived. I'm trying to put together all of these things that I learn about. I usually write something about it or talk on the radio show. I'll put this interview up on the blog eventually. So we'll have that. And I'm really happy to be able to put that all together with you today. So you can sign up for my newsletter at my website and stay in touch with me. I also offer free consultations for 15 minutes if you have a few questions, or right. you can also consult with me in a more extensive manner, and that's offered at my website.
Great. Well, thanks so much for being a super duper teacher.
Sure.
Docere, which means in Latin to teach, and that's part of the great service. Thank you so much for. And that does it for another edition of the Natural House Call. This is Dr. Z. You can always get in contact with me, too, if you want, if you read a good book or come across a great guest like, you know, Carol or anything like that. You can always send me an email and we'll have that guest on. And that is at Dr. Z. You could spell out Dr. Z naturally at gmail.com or drznaturally@gmail.com. Make it a great day and stay healthy. Bye.